This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome once again to our Wednesday Twilight Show. I'm your host, Michelle, and joining me tonight are two formidable women, Miss Yolande Biosa and Mrs. Sarah Wilkinson-Crute. Together, we will discuss women in education and leadership. The question is, have women smashed the proverbial glass ceiling or merely cracked it? Stay tuned.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Hi there, everyone, and welcome once again to our Wednesday Twilight Show. Once more, we are here to talk it out, so do tune in. And before I introduce tonight's guests, I'd like to just take a minute to say thank you to those of you who have been tuning in each fortnight, downloading the podcast, and engaging with the discussion. I am truly appreciative of that. And a special shout out to Lacey Robichaud, a teacher in Kent, who has been listening to all the shows so far and downloading and listening and sharing her honest and heartfelt feedback. I'm so happy that the topics and discussions so far have initiated debates and some deep discussions. People have expressed how they've become reflective in their own practice from listening to us here on Teachers Talk Radio. And that's rewarding, and that's what it's all about. It's providing a space for us as educators to talk about the issues that matter most. So thank you so much for joining us, and let me go straight into welcoming my very special guests tonight. We've got Miss Yolande Biosa, who's already here. Hi, Yolande. Good evening. Hello. So Yolande is currently head of school at Al Majd Charter School, operated by Talim in Abu Dhabi. So it's way past her bedtime. So we appreciate the fact that you've given that up for us, Yolande. Thank you so much. She started her journey as an educator in 2013 and has worked predominantly in inner London schools with deprived student populations. She has proudly completed a master's in education leadership from UCL and co-founded a CIC group called Mindful Equity UK with a fellow leader. And that particular organization has really been proactive in helping teachers develop in their craft. We also have a returning guest, and that is Mrs. Sarah Wilkinson-Crute, who actually joined me on my very first show, my debut show, Sarah, and helped to make it such a success. And I just want to say thank you for joining us, and I look forward to hearing from you. Now, Sarah consented to join us tonight at the last minute. And when I was thinking about the show and the topic, I thought, wait a minute, Sarah will have a wealth of information to share with us because she's had her fair challenges in getting on the leadership ladder. So it'd be lovely to hear your experience as well. So listeners, remember, call us or send us a message by downloading the Podbean app. Think about what has been your experience on your journey to leadership. Are you an aspiring leader? What are some of the challenges you've experienced? And is there hope for us as women in education, as women who are aspiring to be leaders? So do tune in and let's talk it out. We will take a very short break to hear from our sponsors, and then we will be hearing from our guests. And you'll also hear a little bit of my experiences as well. Emily, a fellow host on Teachers Talk Radio, welcome, Emily. I know it's past your bedtime as well, so I appreciate the effort. So do stay tuned.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. visit johncatbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio.
Thanks for that. So that's one of our sponsors. It is so important that we do check them out and look at some of the interesting books that they have. I was able to look at some of those books over the weekend. So before we get into the discussion, I always like to start with a little opening remark and give some background to why we're doing and why we're discussing this particular topic. And undoubtedly, it's a topical issue and has been up for debate for a long time, as long as I can remember. So why are we still talking about it? Why are we still talking about the lack of representation or the representation that reflects the number of female teachers in the classroom? Why are we still talking about that in terms of their representation in leadership? Who should be listening? What progress have we made as women? And is there room for growth? So these are just some of the questions I would like us to explore this evening. And of course, I did some research to see what the statistics and research findings have to share. And across the board, it is agreed that female teachers are lagging behind their female counterparts in the private sector when it comes to leadership. And despite making up the majority of the workforce in education, they occupy less of the seats available in the boardroom, specifically in secondary and higher education settings. It is important to note, however, that despite some progress that have been made, women of Black and ethnic minority groups are still lagging even further behind their white peers in securing a senior role in all school settings. And this is supported by a report from the Department of Education, which confirms that female teachers make up a high proportion of the workforce, but are less represented in leadership positions. Now, they did add that this is improving, especially in secondary schools, but we can agree that there is still more work to be done. So teachers from minority ethnic groups, according to the report, are underrepresented in leadership roles compared to the wider teaching population. And this is also improving. So that's a good sign. So tonight, we're not going to be hung up on the statistics because we know that it is a fact that women are less represented in terms of leadership and especially at the senior level. And so sometimes we just have to rip off the Band-Aid, expose the sore so that the healing can take place. And that's what we're going to do tonight. We want to have an open, frank, and honest discussion. And we're doing this to make sure that the next generation of teachers to come will carry on with the baton and make sure that we continue to close that gap. We're not here to bash our male counterparts because we do appreciate them as well. We're not here to tell them to step aside and let us take over, but that we should work alongside them and to occupy the space as well. So I've had my fair share of setbacks in achieving my career goals in leadership. And for a long time, I blamed myself. I would ask myself questions like, should I have been less assertive? Should I not share my opinion and views? Should I have said yes a tad bit more? And eventually, I resigned myself to being the best head of department I could possibly be. However, I began to realize that there were invisible barriers that often blocked my progress. And we talked about the glass ceiling. And I think not only did I face the thick glass ceiling, but walls as well. And as I said before, it is not making excuses, but is making sure that our voices are heard and that we continue to raise awareness on this issue. And without further ado, I'm going to go over to my first guest to speak tonight, and that is you, Yolande. Welcome again, and thanks once again, Yolande, for giving up your time to be with us. As head of school, I know and I understand it's a lot of work and it can get stressful, but thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. So first of all, I'd like you to share with us a little bit about your journey to senior leadership. What challenges did you face and how did you overcome them?
I think the first place I'd like to start is that stepping into education was a choice to walk away from the private sector because I always wanted to have an impact on my community. That was most certainly the first influence for me. Yeah. So essentially, I joined a local school back in London. I'm currently in Abu Dhabi, as you've already mentioned. And in that school, it was a rapid progression through the pipeline of pastoral leadership prior to ever achieving any teaching qualification, which interestingly and statistically is exactly what tends to happen with ethnic minority leaders. They tend to be fast-tracked and focused, and they tend to be the ones that are pushed forward for these pastoral roles. There are definitely some cultural reasons for that, but I suppose we can branch into that later on. My passion most certainly lay within the curriculum side of things, and I was keen to ensure that I didn't cap my progression by ensuring I had my teaching qualification. So I stepped away from that leadership position, and to just give you a snapshot into that, it was classroom assistant, and within 9 months, I went from a classroom assistant to a head of year 13. So that's what I mean by rapid. So I walked away so that I could train to teach. I trained to teach, and then once I had got my QTS, I was made head of department for psychology, which is my subject. And from there, the leadership positions continued. So I went through middle leadership back into pastoral, but focused a lot more in the sixth form realm, from deputy head of sixth form to head of sixth form to assistant head, consulting, and now head of school.
Fantastic. And that is impressive. And we'll talk a little bit more about that, because you mentioned rapid progression, and it definitely is rapid progression if we think about some other people's context. So we would like to talk about that and what made it so quick for you. And you mentioned the pastoral route as well. So we'll definitely delve into that a little bit more. Sarah, could you share with us as well your journey so far, which is probably a little bit different?
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I always wanted to be in leadership from when I started training. So I knew, because I came into teaching a bit later, I was 33. So I kind of knew that was the avenue I wanted to go. So then I obviously started as a teacher, and quite quickly I was looking for a sort of a TLR that I could do that was whole school. So I was given, first of all, a little bit of literacy, and then I moved into the what used to be called the PSHE curriculum, which is now personal development curriculum, because the government at the time were creating this new compulsory curriculum. So I started doing that for about a year, and then so I thought, well, I've done some whole school, but I really wanted to stay in my department of English. So I did quite a few interviews, and I think I'm quite, someone's called me tenacious before, because I'm quite, if I've set my mind on something, I'm going to do it. And I don't care how long it's going to take me, I'm going to do it. So I went for quite a few interviews, and this is just before the sort of lockdown, and I became a head of department for English. So I did that for a little while, and I did enjoy it, but it's, I really enjoyed sort of the curriculum side of things and the training of people. So I moved into another school and did lead practitioner role, and I stayed in that the longest. And that was really good. I really enjoyed lead practitioner, and it gave me a really good whole school responsibility, but also I was within a department, so I could support people within the department as well. So it was kind of the best of both worlds. And you're not kind of, because you're not a head of department, you're not looked at for the the data and all of those things. So I got all the nice bits. So being a lead practitioner was great fun. I really enjoyed that. And then I really wanted to move into senior leadership, and I was offered the opportunity to be an associate assistant principal at the school that I was a lead practitioner in, which was really good, because it meant I got to do, sort of dip my toe, I suppose. That's what the associate roles are for, is for you to see, do I like this? Is this something I want to do? And it was. And then I just became, again, a little bit more relentless with going through an interview process. And Yeah, I'm just about to start my sort of permanent role as assistant principal. So, yeah, it has been a journey, and I've learned a lot about myself, but it also has been exactly agreeing with you. It's been sometimes a bit of a battle with, because I am quite tenacious and I do speak my opinion, and I've found, you know, sometimes that can not always go your way if you're looking for leadership as a female, at least, I suppose.
Yeah. Well, first of all, congratulations, Sarah, and thank you so much for sharing that with us. And just to pick up on something you've said, you talked about the associate assistant role and being relentless in taking the next step, and you use another word there, battle. And this is for both of you ladies. Do you think as women, we have to be a little bit more relentless, and it becomes a little bit more of a battle to get to the top? And maybe not in your own experience, but based on observation. And I'm going to go back to you, Sarah. Why is it a battle? And should it be?
Yeah, do you know what I think it is? And I've done a little bit of reading around this as well, just like when I was prepping for interviews and things. And I think as women, it feels more of a battle, but I don't know whether it actually is. And I think it feels like that because I read something, I think it was in The Guardian, that was about women don't tend to go for jobs if they don't fulfil 100% of the criteria that is on the advertisement. Whereas men, they only need to look at it and think, oh, I'll get 70% of that I can do. I'm going to go for it. And, you know, and I think, is that the battle? But for me, looking at other women that have also climbed the ladder as well, yeah, it does feel like a bit of a battle, because I can only really, I suppose, speak for myself, but it feels a bit of a rejection. I feel it hard when I get rejected. I feel it personally, and I'm not sure if men do. Some men do, and whether they just think, yeah, that's it, on to the next. You do have to be a little bit braver and a little bit more relentless. Because you are battling against people that might be a bit more experienced than you, you know, and also they might have a bit more experience with the interview process. That's a whole other podcast, I should think.
Yeah, of course, of course. Thank you so much. And you mentioned the fact that about the article that you read, that men are more likely to go for jobs even if they don't fit all the criteria. And on Saturday, I went to a conference, a teacher's conference, and that was raised. As women, we go through it and we tick. And if there's one thing that we're not sure we're very good at or that we match up with, we will step back. Whereas men will just go for it anyway. And you said 70%, it could be less than that, Sarah. They will just go for it and sometimes get the job. So Yolande, my question to you is, what do you think are the factors that prevent women from closing this gender gap in leadership?
Oh, to build on what's already been said, I think, so a couple of things. First of all, the research you're both referring to was done by McKinsey, and they actually was as low as 30%. So men, generally in the study, if it was 30% of the job JD that they could do, they would happily apply for it with confidence. Mm-hmm. I think the main difference and the thing that will help us close the gap is when women can confidently accept that their emotions are a superpower rather than a deterrent or an issue. I think oftentimes women are perceived to be overly emotional. We have milestones that happen in our lives that tend to be wrapped around and highlighted by emotion, whether it be having children, whether it be marriage and the changes that brings to work-life patterns, etc. in some cases. Now, sometimes when you are, particularly when I've line managed or been line managed myself, oftentimes the conversations and where the biggest growth happens is when, as a woman, you can accept that, yes, I do feel things maybe perhaps more strongly or more evidently than most men do in their positions. But actually that tends to be our strength. We tend to be able to see the emotional biorhythms of an organization. And if we can harness that and accept that actually, yes, this is true, however, I'm using it in this way, then I think it will feel like less of a battle and more of just a process of growth.
Thank you, Yolande. Two things you mentioned about the milestones that could be seen as a barrier for us, and the idea of being emotional, and we use it against ourselves. But are we using it against ourselves, if you could clarify, or other people are using it against us, these emotions that we express.
I do think it's both. I think there are external factors and sort of inter and intrapersonal factors. So if you think about the intrapersonal, so what is it that we are looking at and within ourselves, whether it be, let's talk about when menopause occurs for a woman and the needs that may occur or changes that need to require for that woman to be able to act fully and stand up fully in her position, whether she's postpartum, all of these different milestones that occur in life. Yes, as an individual, you will see mm-hmm. them affect you in a particular way. However, there is the interpersonal, which is how everyone around you within your working community may receive that, perceive it, how they treat you, how they perhaps even have unconscious biases towards whether you can or cannot do things. And mm-hmm. if you look at the way that HR laws are changing internationally, so in the UK, whether it's now blind CVs where you're removing names and age, so assumptions mm-hmm. aren't being made about your marital status and your age, and therefore making assumptions as to whether you're soon to be able, soon to plan to have children and therefore be going off on maternity. These are the kind of conversations that I've been privy to when I've been on various different SLTs. Now, mm-hmm. that's not to say that that is realistically, if you're thinking of succession planning, conversations that need to be happening. However, should they be happening in a way that unconsciously we are now creating barriers for women to go into positions? Of course they shouldn't. We need to be aware of it. We need to talk about it. And much like why these sorts of conversations, although there is progress and the data is showing there is progress, there is only progress because conversations are being had.
Thank you so much. And that is why we still need to continue these conversations and to continue to raise awareness. And you've actually answered a bit of the question I was going to ask next. And that was, you know, what is being done? What provisions are being made to get more women involved in senior leadership? Is enough being done? And you mentioned the unconscious bias and making sure that some of the laws are changing. Yolanda, could you elaborate a little bit more on the unconscious bias and how they're trying to alleviate some of the issues?
If you think, practical strategies that I'm aware of from various different education bodies would be, you know, as I've mentioned before, the blind CVs, removing personal data, whether it be gender, whether it be the name as well, to avoid any cultural biases, age, if it doesn't pertain to actually whether the person can actually do the role, and just assessing CVs based on skills and previous employment should be all that one needs to make a decision as to whether you would be appropriate for a role. Other practical things are considering offering positions such as headship and other senior roles as paired jobs. So having two head teachers, because one would then be able to have that part-time contract they desire so they can actually have that time with their children guilt-free. Because although we have the oldest, I'd say, method that we've had in the UK, for example, is that 0.8 contract where teachers mm-hmm. are working or leaders are working part-time only 4 out of the 5 days. 9 times out of 10, any teacher who's on a 0.8 will tell you, yeah, but then I spend that day doing admin, or I spend that day catching up on things, when actually the whole point of it was so that you could spend time with your children. If it's going to work effectively, how can we ensure that the practices within the workplace are truly facilitating for that day to truly be a day for them to be with their family, if that's what they've planned for it to be? And so, yes, having two people sharing one role is one thing that a number of local authorities have started to accept and open up to. Thinking about part-time work within teaching and the way that we can have more flexible hours to accommodate maternity and paternity leave. Because if we can make more space and make it easier for fathers as well as mothers to have that time, again, it removes this focus on gender and this weight that sits on the woman to have to do it, and therefore slowing down her leadership progression.
Thank you so much. And that was very insightful, Yolanda. And it's good to know that these things are happening. But my question is, and Siri, you're welcome to answer this as well and to join in. You mentioned the blind CVs, and that is for the selection process. But when the candidate turns up in front of the panel, what is being done to prevent the bias that's then presents itself? Because now they see that here's a woman who's sitting in front of you. And I'm glad that there's no longer this question about whether you're going to become a mother or whatever. But what is being done to, because I asked this question to the panel on Saturday as well, what is being done for leaders to recognize the conscious biases that we have to not want to employ this woman despite her credentials on that blind CV?
Just to answer that, Sarah, feel free to cut me off at any point. To be honest, again, the various different practices that I've seen, or good practice that I've seen across different education institutions, would be to ensure that any recruitment panel is representative. If the woman walks into a room and the only people interviewing her are older men, how are they truly going to be sure that they have addressed their bias and that bias is not going to be present in that interview conversation? Mm-hmm. So I think that's most certainly the very base starting point that any organization can begin with. But it also goes the other way though, Michelle. I do think that the woman needs to walk in there knowing exactly what she's prepared to do, what her yeses are, what her noes are, because ultimately, although yes, we want to go into leadership, and yes, as women we want to progress, we equally need to not walk into these interviews almost like begging and hoping that someone will choose us, but rather we know that we are good enough for the role. We are the right person for the role. And it's more of a conversation than an interview. I'm assessing you and you're assessing me. And if isn't as an organization and a candidate, we seem to be simpatico, then fine. This would be a strong working relationship. If we're not, it was a pleasure meeting you. But at least I know that I've shown up in that as a confident candidate, as opposed to one who's hoping that I'll be selected, which I think is an attitude change. But it's an important one.
Yeah, thank you. Sarah, do you want to add anything to that or ask any questions?
It was fascinating listening just there, because I totally agree. Obviously I've been through this process quite recently. So when you go into any interview, and in the back of my mind, funnily enough, is I'm thinking to myself, who am I going to see? Am I going to see a woman on who's going to interview me, or is this going to be 3, 4, sometimes 5 men that are all going to be looking at me? And then that can feel a bit intimidating as well. So I think Yolanda is absolutely right, is those panels being representative of the people that they're going to be interviewing? Because I do, and this again could be a personal thing for me, but I do look for the other women. The first thing I notice when I go to any school, if I'm visiting a school, the first thing I notice is where are the women in leadership? And I have a look around, are SLT, you know, how much of SLT are women, and what's the ratio of men to women? And that could be just because I'm used to looking for other women, you know, fellow people that I can join in arms. It is interesting when you go into an interview, and I have been in a few in the past. And it, for me personally, I do find it a bit intimidating when it's all men staring at you. And I always wonder, are they thinking, even though legally they might not be able to ask me a certain question about my home life, I always wonder, are they looking at my age and making their own assumptions? It's an interesting point, I think, that.
Yeah, and one that we should really continue to talk about and to make sure that it gets to the right people and the policymakers. And that's one of the questions I also raised on Saturday. Who are these policymakers and are they really getting the message? Now, the fact that there are some improvement, they are, but of course, there's always room for more improvement. And Yolanda, you mentioned about walking into an interview as a woman and being confident. Are you suggesting that sometimes as women, we are so self-deprecating that we walk in feeling defeated already? Do we need to do more work around that?
100%. And that's an unequivocal point for me. I think the vast majority of women, and a lot of the women that I've coached currently or in the past, it's the same sad narrative. Am I good enough? Imposter syndrome comes out. And regardless of the years of experience, the data behind them, the lives that they've impacted and changed, the curriculum or curricula that they have gone through, written, edited, still they will walk into an interview thinking that they are fortunate to have even been shortlisted. And to me, that's just the majority of the work that I do as a line manager, as a coach, when I'm consulting, it's purely around being a cheerleader. And if I think back about alongside my career, why I feel that, I know Sarah used the word tenacious, and that was just, that's within her character. I think I'm definitely tenacious, but I'm a tenacious person who's had incredible cheerleaders along the way. And if I didn't have those cheerleaders, I'm pretty sure that my journey would still be, I'd still be on that journey to leadership. And I don't believe I'd be ahead of school now. Because ultimately confidence is, what's the saying? Fake it till you make it. And, right. And it's true, because ultimately, the 9 times out of 10, if you ask any senior leader, particularly heads, vice principals, it's not necessarily what they're able to do, it's the network they have. They don't know the answer to everything. I don't know the answer to everything, but I know that I have within my network someone I can reach out to who can answer a question that I might face. For example, today I had a safeguarding issue that happened. I'm in a different country, different laws. I knew that what I'd do in the UK, but I wasn't certain what I'd do here. But already I know exactly who I can call to clarify and answer a question to make sure that we're on the right path. Mm-hmm. Networking is incredibly important. And we speak about colloquially about having your tribe. It is very important for women to filter into and be part of networks in teaching, having that tribe to support you that you can fall back on and ask those questions to. So yes, going back to your original point, is it a question of a lack of confidence? 100%. But is it fixable? Definitely. And it's quite straightforward. Network, get yourself involved with different events, speak to other leaders who've clearly walked that beaten path, and use those experiences and narratives to give you confidence to give it a go yourself. We've all made those mistakes, we've all had those terrible interviews, but again, there is a wealth of knowledge and experience out there that can help to build your confidence. And again, just fake it until you make it.
And aligning yourself with the right people as well. And I love the idea, Yolanda, about networking and having those cheerleaders in your corner. And I think if I should reflect on my time in education, I think some of those things were somewhat lacking. The networking, because probably I wasn't even aware of some of the agencies that I could have aligned myself to. Yes, you know, the cheerleaders are there, but, you know, how much support can you get from the people who themselves didn't have all that wealth of experience? So I do agree with that. And it's about building that confidence as us women. So women out there listening, you know, let us put our shoulders back. And as Yolanda said, fake it till you make it. Make sure that you're aligning yourself with the right people and walk in there with the confidence, because research has shown that women make great leaders. And we really need to start believing that. We're going to take another short break. In the meantime, please remember to download the Podbean app, call in, text. Let us hear what you think about women in leadership. What is holding us back? Are we holding back ourselves? Or are there mainly external factors that seem to be keeping us in our little boxes or in our lanes? So do get in touch and let's hear what you think. Stay tuned.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers.
Fantastic. Yes, we know this is Teachers Talk Radio. Welcome back, everybody. And we're going to continue with this discussion. And so far, we've talked about some of the barriers that women have faced in rising to the top, and not just leadership, because we occupy a lot of the space in middle leadership. And we're talking mainly about getting to the very top as senior leaders, and that for some people, it has been a struggle. And there are different reasons. Sometimes it's within us, we hold ourselves back, we doubt ourselves, and we fail to push forward. Or we just don't align ourselves with the right networking. And that's what's coming out tonight. So we're going to go through a little bit more of some of our own personal experiences and unpick that. But before that, ladies, do you think female heads should also feature in this debate? Are they a part of the problem? And I'm asking this because I've heard a number of people saying female head teachers themselves can be so toxic that they hold back others. Now, this is based on your own opinion, but do you think as women, we fail to fix each other's crowns, we'd rather just take the moat out of people's eyes? Sarah, I'm going to start with you because Yolanda, as a head yourself, I'd love to hear your perspective. But Sarah, what do you think? Do you think female head teachers need to step up a little bit more, be our cheerleaders and push us forward?
Yes, in a word. I've had a mixture of female and male head teachers before. And I have to say, the female head teachers have been a bit harsher on me than the male teachers. And I don't know whether they are doing it because they think that it's a way of, you know, making me a bit more confident and that I need to learn, you know, toughen up a little bit. But in my own experience, the female head teachers have been a little bit more cutting and they haven't been as supportive. But I have had female leaders, so SLT leaders and middle leaders that have been incredibly supportive. It just seems to be when they get to the headship side, I don't know whether that's because of the pressure that's above or perhaps they're just testing me. I don't really know. But in my own experience, I've not had good experiences with female head teachers, but that is my own experience.
Thank you. Thank you so much. And thanks for being so honest. And you mentioned that they're sometimes very cutting. Yolanda, why do you think this could be the case? Why are female head teachers, and we're not generalizing here, some female head teachers, why are they so reluctant to support other women?
I think I have to go back to something you said earlier about, you know, that you yourself weren't aware of networks and, you know, organisations that you could connect with, etc. And I think it just goes back to historically, what examples of leadership have they themselves historically, so former female heads, ever seen? And so you can only really be what you've seen. And if they're emulating men, which often tends to be the sort of trope that is plastered around female heads that, oh, you know, she's just trying to put on men's trousers, so to speak. And then if a woman is embodying male characteristics, she's now being a bully, she's aggressive, she's being too curt or harsh on people. What else would you expect? Then you have the counter opposite where you'll have some female heads who try to literally be the counter opposite of all of those characteristics. Then they're characterized as being weak, too emotional. I'm not saying that either of them are necessarily good or bad. I think we are yet to devise what female leadership can look like with all of the tools in place. Men have had the tools, the support, the ability to make mistakes on lower stakes for a longer period of time than women have. Female leadership in education is a new phenomenon. It's not that it's never happened, but on the scale that it's beginning to happen, it's still novel. And so it's only fair to give women grace in this time period of growth and development to make those mistakes and to also utilize the feedback that we're receiving to then adapt the way that we lead. I think over the years, the type of women leaders that I've worked with, whether it be headship or senior leadership, has evolved. And there are certainly more motherly figures, there are more emotional ones, but equally I've worked with women in leadership who are, I call them the STEM leaders, who are very black and white. But it's, I think, again, it just goes back to us giving female leadership a lot more grace, because we're a young type of leadership in education. And so lessons are being learnt and change is coming for sure.
Thank you so much. So where do we find the balance then? Because you talked about female leadership, and if they're too strong or draconian in their ways, then they're being compared to men, you know, you're behaving too masculine. And if they show more of the traditional feminine qualities, so to speak, then they're considered weak. So who should be providing that framework, Yolande, to make sure that we have that balance? Where do you think that should come from?
That's a really good question. I think, first of all, we need to get to a space where the genderization of these characteristics fades away. If I'm having to have a challenging conversation with a member of staff, or whether it be to, you know, the very sad end where I'm having to terminate a member of staff, I'm not embodying a man to do that. I'm just using a particular bucket of skills from my toolbox to address that. They don't have a gender. Those are just the skills I use for that particular interaction. If I'm praising my staff or celebrating them or providing feedback, again, you use different skills. All of those skills for me personally are genderless. They are just skills that I find to be effective in that context. Now, where does all of that come from? It comes from me feeling like I can show up authentically as myself. I'm not embodying anyone. I'm being myself and using the skills I've developed over the years, working across various different school institutions. Fundamentally, if we can get to a point, as I earlier said, that we're not looking at this, at these skills through the lens of gender, and we're looking at them as what are effective ways of dealing with different scenarios and situations that occur in schools, again, that's where the balance will come in, because the women are being given the grace to use the skills as they choose. And equally on the other side, though, the men are able to use skills that perhaps historically would be feminine skills to lead in more effective ways. So essentially, I think the question goes back to what is effective school leadership? What skills are necessary to address different situations?
Yeah. Thank you so much. Sarah, do you want to add anything to that? About the support or
I mean, I totally agree that the that men have, we were talking earlier about the men having a bit more support as they're coming up, if you like, the support that they get, and women being not being allowed to make those mistakes early on in their career. And I think that's a really important point. I think things are changing. I mean, I say, and I totally agree with Yolande when she said about how, where are the head teachers, female head teachers, getting their sort of experience from, because they would have had male head teachers. And I kind of agree with that, because some of the female head teachers I've had were slightly older, and maybe that was what happened. But I think things are changing, and I definitely have found that the SLT members and the middle leaders that are now coming through the ranks, those women that are coming through the ranks are much more supportive. And I definitely feel that there's a lot more discussion, an open discussion between colleagues that are middle leaders or sort of AP, assistant head teacher roles, that are having these open conversations about male and female leadership. But it is interesting, and I'm loving listening to Yolande. She's got some really good insights on. I love the things she said. I just want to say it out so it's public. The things she said earlier about the emotion side of it being a superpower. I absolutely love that, because I've always been told that my fiery personality, I suppose, my opinions are just too much for people. And, you know, I just need to tone it down a bit, because maybe you're just a bit too much for people. And actually, sometimes it's quite nice just to get those things out and speak to people on the same platform. Otherwise, because you can come across sometimes, can't you, as if you're opinionated, or you've got an opinion, you don't even have to be opinionated, just an opinion on something. It's difficult to not come across as if you're bullish, or as Yolande was saying about being taken on a man's role. I know one thing I did notice, which is an interesting thing, just a reflection on myself, is that as soon as I stepped into the associate assistant principal role, I started to change the way that I dress. I did start to dress a little bit more masculine. It sounds weird, but I did. And I just felt as if I needed to be on that same level. There was a little bit more trouser wearing going on than there was before. So it was quite.
And the power suit?
Absolutely, the power suit. And what I tell you what is interesting. I'm sorry to interject.
Go for it. Go for it.
Yolanda was saying earlier about women that sharing roles in the leadership run. I've seen a lot of that on, online, where I've seen women celebrating their successes and being part of a job role in the leadership roles. But it's interesting because when I notice these sort of things, when I look at women, I sit, around an SLT table or even like in the middle leaders, and I look at the women around, they are kind of wearing the power suit. And, you know, it's interesting when I watch things on the television and I think of women that are in a leadership role, whether it's in education, wearing the big power suit. You don't see many flowers. not many colours. Women wearing flowers when they're in the leadership roles. Yeah, they're wearing, you know, the blacks, the greys, the navies,
exactly,
the dark greens.
Oh, fantastic. I'm going to continue that discussion in a bit, but I'd just like to read some of the comments. Emily said, an angry male leader might be viewed as strong, whereas a female leader would be seen as hysterical or shrill. Okay, and that is a fact indeed. She also said, she read somewhere that in order for women, for female political leaders to be accepted by the voting public, they cannot just exhibit the traits historically associated with leadership. If she does, then there will be a backlash because she's offending, she's going against or unconscious gender stereotypes. And we saw that in the UK as well. And, you know, the media focuses on what the female prime minister was wearing and how she crossed her legs rather than her attributes as a leader. And then it goes back to your point, Sarah, then we have to dress a certain way to fit into the mold that is created and that's expected from us as leaders. And I also agree that, yes, I love that point. I actually noted it, Yolanda, that our emotions, that is our superpower. And we should embrace it and then channel it as well to support and help others and to be great leaders. Would you like to say something further, Yolanda?
Yeah, just that it's a very Western phenomenon that this, ironically, you know, when we went through the world wars in the West and women were drawn into the workforce for the first time en masse, it is still, regardless of how many years women have been working and leading and pioneering, even still this conversation and narrative around how feminine or unfeminine a woman may be. I mean, Hillary Clinton's campaign for presidency is another example of this. But then if you look at the African nations who have female presidents, these are not the sorts of conversations that were happening during their campaigns. Likewise, in the Caribbean with female presidents and prime ministers, again, these are not the conversations or narratives that were happening. So it's really interesting why in the West this seems to be this hyper focus on what should be allowed to be, what should be okay for a female leader. Should it be the way that she's dressing? Is has she cared about her makeup? Is her hair a certain way, etc., rather than commenting on her decision making, her actions, her outcomes.
Yeah, totally agree. Thank you so much. And whilst we're having this discussion, I was just thinking about some experiences I've had and witnessed over the years. And it makes me question whether or not our female head teachers, especially in the past, really had the full support of staff, whether male or female. And I recall once a particular head teacher, female head teacher, and she was leading our staff meeting because back then, we had proper staff meeting where the budget is read out and all of that. And that woman was vilified. I was new to the school and I could not understand what was going on. And the men were heckling her in the meeting and kept interrupting and shouting and speaking over her. And she got so frustrated, she grabbed her stuff and stormed off and left the stage. And she just refused to engage. And now thinking about that, you know, they had all sorts of names, but, the question is, did they give her a chance? Did they support her? Or did they just want to get rid of her because of her gender? Now, she was replaced shortly after that by a man, and the attitude was completely different. Suddenly, everybody became compliant. So I'm not saying maybe she didn't have qualities that people weren't fond of, But it was just so interesting to see that when the male head teacher turned up, the tides turned and everybody fell in line. So again, how supported are these women? And are they forced to then take on this persona to be strong and tough and, you know, very strong-headed because of the backlash they could get as well if they do otherwise? You're welcome to expand on that or comment if you wish.
Yeah, I agree. I do think that I've been on a bit of a journey. As I say, I came into teaching at the age of 33, so I was a bit older, and I spent 7 years in the fire service, which predominantly, there are obviously women in fire service, but predominantly it's men in uniform as well. And then I came into the teaching world, and I think that looking at the teachers that were around me, and there was predominantly women, loads of females, especially, I'm in English, that's my subject specialist, loads of women in English. You get actually the men are in the minority in English a lot of the time, unfortunately, but it'd be nice to have that sort of gender balance. But yeah, absolutely, I think that, you know, women are, I think some women just naturally do that, and I've definitely learned to become a bit of a chameleon in teaching. So I do adapt to who I'm speaking to and where I am, and if I am in a formal setting, I do take on a bit more of a masculine persona. I think I tend to do that, and if I'm in a meeting, and sometimes I do watch myself, because I think that I, as you say, and you said it yourself about being fire or opinionated, or have you been too much, you're not sure, and I always think to myself, oh. And I listen to some of the men, and I've seen men like shouting at each other in meetings or getting annoyed with each other. And I think to myself, God, if I did that, they would think I was, like you said, hysterical. They would think I'm just getting emotional, and they'd sort of, you know, would they think that or not? I don't know. So I tend to just stay quiet. Exactly. And then sometimes I just have to say something because it's just too much for me to stay quiet, and I have to say something. But I do find that as women, I don't know if it's something we've learned. I don't know if it's something I've learned, but I've seen women change depending on where they are, who they're with. They do. There are a bit more of a chameleon. Men just are themselves. They just seem to be anyway. They seem to be just themselves in whatever context. But women tend to morph into different personalities depending on who's in front of them, who's speaking to them. And that, you know, talking about what we're wearing and things, it's a very similar thing. There's lots of things. Oh, I'm going to a very formal, you know, governor's meeting. What should I wear? I'll have to wear something a little bit more, you know, stronger, that shows me in a stronger light than if I was in, you know, a middle leaders meeting or something like that. So it's, these are just interesting points. These are just things that I've noticed having going up through the ranks and sort of seeing people on different levels. And I am a bit of a people watcher, and I find teachers, especially because I came in a bit later, teachers are fascinating because they do morph, and they sort of go into different personalities and different zones in their heads depending on where they are.
Yeah, we're weird and wonderful creatures. Yolande, you have, I'm sure you've had the opportunity to be around male head teachers. Sarah said for women, we tend to be a bit of a chameleon and we just watch from the sidelines and speak when we really have to. What has been your observation?
So I wear many hats. So currently I'm a head of school. I'm also on the board of trustees for a 90 year old charity in the UK called the Outward Bound Trust. And the reason I mention that is because they've consciously had to diversify their board. Their board was filled with male royals who are very particular about how they expect certain things to be run and delivered. When you work for male heads, there are two types. There are those who tell you what to do, and there are those who are the kings of delegation. Then you have what's the positive opposite for the female gender? And in the West, we refer to gravitas. And that narrative, that anecdote you spoke about of this female head who was clearly treated appallingly by those members of staff at that time, I think gravitas is something that as a female leader you have to learn to develop and wield really well. It enables me to effectively walk into any situation now and ensure that people know what my expectations are. But all of that gravitas is underpinned by firm, strong bonds and relationships that you take time to build. In the Arab culture that I work in now, they have a word in Arabic that means wasta, and wasta is in reference to a level of respect. There are certain people who walk into spaces and they can say one thing and everyone falls into line immediately. And it was really funny, last week someone said to me, I need to use your wasta. I said, I beg your pardon, because I actually thought it was a word that was only for men. But it just, it's the equivalent, I would say, that we have in English is gravitas. It's who is that person who can walk into a room and command the respect and attention of people. Now, how and why we get that as a woman, I think it's by our acts. And but again, we spoke about earlier in the show about women having CVs and experience letters that are a mile long and still having imposter syndrome. It's having the experience, but also blowing the trumpet loudly and confidently of what you have achieved. It's taking the we situation and finding the I within it when you're talking to someone who's a potential employer. And if you know what actions you took to achieve it, you can confidently say that I can replicate this in another context. And so this is where your confidence comes from, for you to then have gravitas when you are now leading. And it then allows you to more, I remember vividly being that chameleon who goes into lots of situations, adapting to different scenarios. And interestingly, the higher I've gone, the chameleon has calmed down. And I know, and it genuinely has, because I know who I am as a leader and what my hard yeses are and what my hard nos are. And that then gives others confidence to trust in me and my decision making. So I think it's a necessary journey you go on, but I think it's a part of the development of becoming a leader, the higher up you go.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Yolande. That is so insightful. And I'd just like to go to the chat. We've got Talene who said, I believe that if you are right, you are right. And that shouldn't be related to gender. And if you see yourself less than a man, then no change will happen. Just show them that you can do the work as men and even better. This is happening more in the Middle East, not 100% in Lebanon, it is. Most of the leadership members are women. So we do agree that, you know, there are changes, and we should accept our skill sets and go with it and be confident. But at times, especially as women, we can be so self-deprecating. And that is the thing. And that is something we need to start training our girls from early, you know, to embrace who they are and to have a voice and to be willing to share that voice and not feeling as though there are restraints. Express themselves and develop that confidence from very early. Emily has a question for you, Sarah. He said, how did your previous job in the fire service help you as a leader today?
I would say it helped me because I have met so many different people from different walks of life. And I think it and you have to listen when you're in a public service, a real sort of like emergency service. A lot of your job is listening. And it's listening to other people and working out, you know, thinking about your behaviour or your reaction to something before you do it. So I think as a leader, it helped me work out personalities and people. It's probably why I'm fascinated by teachers, because I think teachers are absolutely amazing people. I mean, I am a teacher, obviously. even before that, I thought they were amazing. That's why I wanted to be a teacher. And even more so when I joined the profession. But I think I've met so many different people from all walks of life. I've been in different houses. I've been in different fire stations. I've spoken to different officers of different levels that are, you know, where you have to call them Gov and you have to call them Sir and things like that. So, and it, you know, from the army, when the army used to come in and we used to do emergency services with the army when we had a Channel Tunnel fire once and we had all of the army in, a very high up army officers. But you just, and actually that was much more human, I suppose, because it wasn't, you were talking, it was all emotion and all instincts. That's how the emergency services work. It's all, you don't have time to think about how you're going to speak to that person. You do it and then you do the debrief afterwards. And so when I went into teaching, what I did find difficult at first was not doing and then debriefing. It was all kind of, you know, so if you was in meetings or something, I would say something and people would disagree. And I'd be like, well, yeah, but we're just going to need to do this because this is what we need to do. And so I had to sort of retrain myself that actually I'm not in an emergency situation. There's no life or death situation here. I can calm down a bit. But it was fascinating because you see people in different circumstances. And when someone is panicking and they're in emergency service, they are a different person. And I got used to that sort of quick pace of do it now, do it because I've told you to do it. Because if you don't do it, we're not going to get this person out or something like that. So it was, you know, you just reacted straight away. And I think I had to almost dial that down a bit when I went into teaching because it's not life or death in teaching. So it was very interesting. But something I wanted to pick you up, you said earlier about women empowering other women, especially in leadership. And we were talking about what was we talking about? When you were saying about how the emotion side of it.
Yeah.
And I think what's interesting about, I don't tend to stay quiet in meetings, but I was told, and this was by a female head teacher, and I was told, because I think Yolanda was saying about gravitas, I was told when I first started this job, this middle leader position, by the female head teacher, and she told me that I had too much confidence and I had to dial it down a bit because I was too intimidating. And that has stuck with me for a few years. And it stuck with me for a long time because I thought I was stepping up into a sort of middle leadership and I was running a department and I've been told I've got to dial it down. And I didn't know how to because I am me, as you can probably tell. Yeah, you can hear it in my voice. I'm loud, I'm bubbly, I'm just this kind of fun person, but also, you know, I know how to get things done. And I was told that I was making other people uncomfortable because I was too much. And I suppose that came from my fire brigade background, because it is like, I just need you to do this. If it doesn't work, fine, we'll talk about it. But right now, you need to roll this out. Yeah. That wasn't appreciated. And that was, interestingly, a female head teacher who has since retired. So that gives you an idea of the age that we're talking about. But it's very interesting what Yolanda said about earlier. And I just think all of this ties in nicely, actually.
Yeah, thank you so much. And Emily said, no way, so sad, Sarah. Leaders should allow staff to show up as themselves. And thank you for that, Emily, because for me, in my experience, that has been one of my barriers, showing up as myself. I remember once I said to a head teacher, I'd love to do the MPQSL. And, you know, the head teacher looked at me and said, what is that? And this is a head teacher who was very much involved in the creation of all these modules. And I was in shock. I said, pardon? A couple of weeks later, when I had handed in my notice, it was being offered to other members of staff. On another occasion, I submitted my application and the head teacher, female, both of them, a different one, she said, oh, yes, I've submitted it. All good. And then when I spoke to the providers, they said they were yet to receive it. And, you know, I always think, why? Why don't they want me to go forward? Why don't they want me to, you know, step into leadership or get the necessary training? And sometimes that really bothered me and burdened me. I'm like, what is it? You know, why are they holding back these opportunities? You know, but I've had to just keep moving and putting that behind me. But those are some of the experiences I've had. And we talked earlier about being of the Black and ethnic minority group as well, Yolanda. And after the news, we would like to pick up on that a little bit more. And we'd like to talk about women as mothers who are in leadership. So those are two of the things I'd like to discuss after the news. Thank you so much for all your comments. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in. Do stay tuned. Do not go just yet. Let's listen to the news and we'll be right back.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
School absence, a seemingly ever-present feature in our news at the moment, has raised its head again, this time in the form of fines for parents. The Guardian covers the detail that fines in England for unauthorised absence are set to rise by 33%. Education Secretary Gillian Keegan said she was bringing penalties under a national framework to help tackle inconsistencies. The Department for Education said fines must be considered if a child misses 5 days of school for unauthorised absence. Under the new rules, the initial penalty notices will increase from £60 to £80 per parent per child. Anyone who cannot pay within 21 days will have to pay £160 rather than the current £120. Schools will also share daily registers online with the Department for Education as part of the drive to improve. ASCL's Jeff Barton said the wider issues linked with poor attendance, such as anxiety, disengagement with education and wider social problems, needed addressing by working with families rather than fining them. Labour's Bridget Phillipson said the Conservative government was only just waking up to the damage of persistent absence, but that they should address the causes rather than the symptoms. The Daily Mail highlights the continuing difficulties faced by some schools in recruiting appropriate specialist staff for some subject areas. It reports on one school's desperation and the measures they have had to take by putting large numbers of pupils into masterclasses to support the teaching of science GCSE. Whilst the article describes the decision as a drastic measure, it points out that there is a nationwide crisis in teacher recruitment and retention, and government missing its teacher training targets yet again. Schools are increasingly using non-specialist teachers to cover classes, so the masterclass approach could be here to stay for a little while longer. School holidays featured in the news again, with the debate centering on the long summer break. It prompted much discussion on social media, and teachers, school staff and parents all joined in the debate. The Guardian, however, chose to focus on the benefits one school trust said it had noticed, this time in the area of staff attendance and well-being. The Unity Schools Partnership Trust found that staff absences fell by 50% after it extended the autumn half term by a week in both its primary and secondary schools. Pupil illness absence also fell by 25%. 58% of parents supported the change, which is now permanent, although parents of younger children expressed worries around childcare. In Wales, the BBC reports that the government has admitted to failing to follow the law when stopping free school meals during the holidays after the summer of 2023. Two families and a legal charity claimed ministers had not considered the rights of children. The government accepted it should have done more to assess the effect of the decision, but the Education Minister in Wales said the government could not afford to reintroduce the meals. The government will have to pay the legal costs of the claimants. Finally, the BBC also focuses on a scheme in one Lancashire high school which is encouraging students to embrace phone-free days. Pupils are able to hand in their mobile phones before lessons, and pupils themselves report greater focus and fewer distractions. But the school leaders also report reductions in incidents of bullying and online abuse. Esther Jai, mother of murdered schoolgirl Brianna Jai, has also had a video meeting this week with PM Rishi Sunak to discuss her campaign for greater online safety and an age limit for smartphones. She described the meeting as really productive. Schools were issued new guidance on mobile technology in February of this year. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio News with Jo Fox.
Thanks for that, Jo. Lots of information there, especially for us here in the UAE, Yolanda. It's nice to keep abreast of what's happening in the UK. And thank you, everybody. Thank you so far for everybody's tuned in and joined in and sharing your opinions. Talene, thanks for joining. Good night. You have to go off now, but thank you so much. Talene said very engaging talk, and that female leaders make good role models if they are the right leaders. And that is so true. We also have a question from Emily, which I will ask in a bit. But just to go back to our current discussion about women as leaders, do you think women with young children can be effective leaders? And how are they generally perceived? Yolanda, let's start with you.
I think this is a brilliant question. And it's a question that I think just needs one simple answer. We all need to remember that if you have a child, that your working day will look different to others. So far as that fact is shared and communicated widely, no one should have any issue with the mother being a leader. For example, just because a mother might leave out of the school gates along with the students does not mean that in that evening when she's at home and she's fed her kids that she's not then catching up on the work that everyone else may have done an hour after school being completed. She may then schedule her emails to be received or send from her laptop in the morning to make sure that she's not impacting on other people's workload and working hours. There is no reason for a child to be seen as a negative factor. It's all about communication and transparency and to ensure that actually their work and their efforts are being acknowledged, because they'll just look different. And not to say that we should be like, oh, they're a mum, we should give them less work. No, they just work differently.
Yeah. That is an interesting perspective. They just work differently. It doesn't mean that they won't be effective, but their day will just look so different. Thanks for that. Sarah, what do you think? Can moms make effective leaders?
Yeah, absolutely.
You're a mom. Tell us.
Yeah, absolutely. I've got three children. Mine are slightly older now. I've got a 19-year-old, a 16-year-old, and an 11-year-old. Wow. But I started teacher training when my 11-year-old was a baby in arms. So, it was and that was a bit much as a teacher, actually, not even a leader. But actually, I think women are incredible organisers. And when you have children, you have to be organised. And I think you do that naturally. That skill passes over into your work life because you become a really good organized person, and you start to think, right, exactly what Yolande said. So I think, right, I've got to take my daughter to her appointment or a club at 4 o'clock. So I think to myself, okay, that means I can't do my marking until 6:30 by the time I've eaten and got in. Other people will have done it at school between 4 and 5. I do it between maybe 6:30, 7. So I'm still putting in the hours and I'm still doing what everyone else does, and you're planning for the next day and you're doing planning for your meetings that you're going to have, but it does just looks differently. But I do think one of the really good things, any mum that I've met that's been a leader, they are just so organised. They've got diaries, you know, some people have got things on their phones, reminders, calendars, things at whiteboards, the kids know exactly where to go in at one time. So I just think that actually it's more of a positive than anything, because you get that organisation really does spill over into being a leader. You are a leader of your children and a leader of the people.
But do you think society perceives it as such, or do you think there's a shift in mindsets towards women who are mothers and leading?
I don't think we're there yet with the I think the I think with younger leaders, yes. I think, and I've noticed that it, male or female, if they've got a young family, there seems to be a to in and fro between male or female, that, you know, there's a give and take there. But I think maybe with some of the older leaders that have maybe been doing it a bit longer, not so much. I do feel like even though you're not allowed to ask questions like children and if you're getting married and stuff in interviews, but I know that they can find out other ways. So, you know, when you're walking around a school on the interview day or, you know, something like that, they'll just throw it into conversation and they sort of, do they make then a decision on that? I don't know. But certainly as leaders, I think society's still got a little bit more way to go. In terms of just accepting that actually people, not just mothers, but people are parents, you know, because, you know, if a woman's a mother, somebody out there, a man's a father. So, you know, it's a 50-50 thing. Yeah. But I think for men, it's never, people don't assume it, do they? Yeah. And I think my phone's gone off in a meeting. And it's been my son who's locked out or something because he's forgotten his door key again for the fifth time. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but I just make my excuses and it's fine. But I think I've been in other situations where that hasn't been. So,
Thank you. So I'm really happy, though, that there's a shift. And based on our discussion tonight, there seems to be a shift where people are a little bit more open to what women have to offer and what they come with. And I, when I was planning the show and the discussions, I remembered when back in the day when I was still in my childbearing years, I turned up for an interview, heavily pregnant, to be second in charge of English. And this was a long time ago. And when I talk about being heavily pregnant, I was actually having contractions during that interview. And it was 2 days after my maternity leave had started. And I sat there and I answered all the questions. I didn't grimace once. And I was so confident and I leaned in and I thought, yes, I'm ideal for this role. I've been in the department and I know I can take it forward. But then just thinking about it recently, I'm thinking, here I am sitting in an interview, heavily pregnant, being interviewed by a man. I'm thinking, what must have been going through that man's mind at the time? What does she think is going to happen here? You're about to give birth. You're about to become a mom. Why would you want to give you the job when you will have potentially have childcare issues and all sorts of issues, and maybe it will impact on your attendance? So again, it's that unconscious bias. But at the time, I wasn't even thinking like that. So as Yolanda said, go in with the confidence. And I did. I went in with all that confidence, but I had a huge tummy in front of me as well, which was probably already swaying this man's mind. And I didn't get the job, and I was really annoyed about that. And that takes me to a question that Emily posed earlier. She said, how do you overcome rejection after an interview if you didn't get the job? So it's all about being woman and how do we cope with things. So Yolanda, would you, I don't know if you've had any rejections.
I have. If you have. I have, but... So I have to give a caveat and explain why I always say I haven't. First of all, I know what's exactly the type of school that I will work for. And I never bend on it. I know exactly the type of school that I'm interested in working in, because they all reflect the type of school that and the type of area that I grew up in. And that is my why. I know exactly why. And come
yes,
from,
I think we're,
right?
Okay.
Who come from socially deprived, economically deprived areas. So far as those that community exists in the school, I know 100% I'm a strong candidate for that position, if not the best candidate for that position. Mm-hmm. If I've ever gone for a job where it's like I wonder what that would be like, I know I'm not going to get it. Because I know it's not the type of school for me, and I know I won't show up as my full self and my skill set. I can't sell that because I don't believe in that. Case in point, I have applied for a grammar school before, and mm-hmm. I went even within like the tour. I was like, "Why am I here? Why have I done this?" But I did it out of pure curiosity. I was like, "Oh well, you know, you've got the qualifications. They're very nearby. It'd be a wonderful opportunity, wouldn't it?" Yeah, but they're not the student population you want to work for. Because it didn't go with my why, it made no sense me being there. I wasn't selling myself to my 100% of my ability. And therefore, I'm no longer believable to these employers. I can see on their face they're not interested. I know I'm not interested. I knew I wasn't going to get the job. So when I say I've had rejections, but I knew they were coming.
Yeah.
And the reason I knew I was coming, and the advice that I would give to anyone listening would be, you have to know why you want that job. If you know it matches with why you're in education, the sort of step you want to take, not the quote unquote selfish reason, you know, I want the pay rise. Do you want to work with these type of children? Is there something in this department, in this school that you can see that you can fix? If that's the case, you authentically will come through as a strong candidate because you are passionate and you care about it. And that sells itself. But if you walk into an interview sort of like, I hope I get it. I really just want the money. Or it'd be nice to do something different. No one's going to believe you. There's fake it till you make it, but also there's a let's not lie to ourselves. So yes, I have been rejected. And how do I deal with it? Because I go into it knowing exactly what I have, what I want, and what I can offer the school. Now, case in example, if I didn't get it in that situation, if all of those things are aligned, I believed that I was right for it, I gave 100% of my ability, I would purely deal with it by, I'd love to get some feedback from you as to why I didn't. Because okay. that will then give you something to take away from it. Either it was an internal candidate, which sadly can sometimes be the case. It may be that there was just a strong pull. Again, that's a wonderful situation to be in because it means that, you know, you've put an impression on them, but clearly it wasn't the right time for you. And that shouldn't dent your confidence. That should show you that actually just on that day, there was a lot of people in the same position. So get that feedback.
Thank you so much. So Emily, I think some very, very wise words there as well. And you know, Yolanda, you're right. You walk into an environment sometimes for an interview and you just walk in and you know immediately that this is not the place for me. And then it begins to show as the day progresses, you begin to feel it and then it begins to be manifested through your body language and maybe even the way you respond. So that's so important as well. Is this what I want? And then you go for it. Thank you so much for that. Sarah, how have you dealt with rejection in that context?
There's been a couple occasions where I've thought I really, really wanted it, and then I haven't got it. They've given me feedback, and I think, oh, actually, they're right. And it was the feedback that actually, you know, you learn from. So I've been really appreciative when they give feedback. It's when you don't get it and they don't give any feedback. They just say no. And they're like, oh, okay. But over, most recently, I suppose, it hurts. I'm not going to lie. I'm quite, you know, I wear my heart on my sleeve. It hurts. No one likes to be told you're not good enough for us or we don't want you, or it's not nice. But I think you just brush yourself down and get on with it. But it is so much easier to take when you know the why. When they give you feedback. And also, I think it's actually quite nice because I think like they've acknowledged the effort that I've gone through to put in the application, to take a day off, you know, from my current school to come to your school. And that, yeah, it's half a day. And, you know, if you're going for senior leadership roles, it could be a day or 2 days. So you put in a lot of yourself into it, you know, your blood, sweat and tears almost. So it's nice to get some actual feedback. And they say, look, we loved you, but there was, you know, an internal person or, you know, somebody was just better with that question or whatever it might be. But, you know, keep doing this or perhaps you want to brush up on that. And then you just take that with you into the next one. So it's not nice. And, it is not nice. I don't like being rejected. Of course not. I have pride. I'm Leo the Lion. So, I'm very proud. But you learn from it. And I think if they can give feedback, and if they don't give feedback, and if I ask for it, because I have done this before, and this was a few years ago, and I asked for feedback. It was a school, and it was a grammar school, and they just said to me, no. And I was like, well, can I have some feedback? And they went, yeah, we'll get back to you. And they never did. And I just thought, you know what? I don't want to work for you, actually. You think, no, because actually you're not, this is a two-way, I think Yolandi said earlier, it's a two-way process, isn't it? And you know whether you like it or not. So that, I think the feedback is really important. If they can do that, that's what you take away and you learn from it. You brush yourself down and you go on, get back
and
on
you
the
go
horse.
Again. Exactly. Yeah. Thank you so much. Believe it or not, we only have a few more minutes left and I would love to hear your thoughts and your final messages. So, Yolande, what would be your message to young female teachers who are aspiring to leadership?
Oh, God. I always think I've prepared for that particular question and I never think I find a nuanced response for you. I just think what I'd like to end, considering all the plethora of knowledge that you've got from Sarah, you and I tonight, I think the core message is know who you are and what you have to offer. Those two things together will put you in good stead. And just one final comment, just to add on to what Sarah was saying there about feedback. The higher up you go, it's less about skill and more about fit. And if you don't fit in with that particular leadership team, it doesn't matter how many qualifications, you could have a PhD, but if you do not fit with that team, you don't fit with that team. It's not personal. And if you can take the person out of it and know that, you can take the knocks a lot better. You just have to find a team that you fit in.
Thank you so much. And it's important that we're honest with ourselves as well about the team. Sarah, what would be your message to young aspiring female leaders?
For me, it would be don't give up after the first, you know, if you get a rejection the first time you go for a leadership role, middle leadership, whatever it might be. You know, these things happen. And, mm-hmm. and don't, you know, just get back on that horse again and learn from it. Look at what you've done. Mm-hmm. You know, if you need more experience, go and get that experience. If they're saying to you, you need more pastoral experience, go and get that experience. Ask the questions, knock on doors, you know, put yourself out there. But keep going. I think the main thing here is keep going. Yeah. It will come. It will mm-hmm. come eventually. When the time is right, and just what Yolande said about being in the right team, the moment will come. You just got right. to keep going.
Yeah. And you get those rejections, you dust yourself off and you go again. And I was reading an article recently, and it's the Dunning-Kruger model of bias and cognitive bias, where it says those who are less competent tends to put themselves forward and then end up making the wrong decisions. And those with the expertise, and according to the article, it's usually the women who tend to step back a little bit. So just to sum up what we're saying tonight, you know, as women, we just need to embrace who we are, believe in ourselves, you know, accept our strengths and our emotions as a superpower, as Yolande said, and put ourselves forward. You know, a number of times Yolande said, fake it till you make it. Go in there and, you know, be confident and assured that you are the best fit for that particular job. And be prepared as well. Do your research. Don't just walk into an interview and think it's a given, but do your research and go in there, because women do make great leaders. And that takes us to the end of tonight's show. Let me just pause to thank all of you who joined. My mom, all the way in Kingston, Jamaica, who stopped everything to listen to the show and every other week. Thank you so much, mom, and everybody else on the platform. Talin, who left earlier but was with us. Emily, and of course, my two amazing guests, Yolande and Sarah, thank you so much. Another fantastic show that was well spent. And listen, women, go out there, smash the glass ceilings. We are nearly there. We're closing the gap. Younger female teachers who are aspiring, you know, look to some other people with the experience and learn from them as well. So thank you all for joining me on Teachers Talk Radio. Thank you for your contributions. And I will see you again in 2 weeks' time. Thank you so much, ladies. Have a lovely evening. And to you, Yolande, actually, good night.
Good night, everyone.
Yeah. Good night.
Thank you so much. Good night. Thank you.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.